Empowered people make informed decisions that lead to living a life without regret. This is Sarah Kaki and Shauna Woods from Atlanta Divorce Law Group, and this is the Happily Ever After Divorce Podcast.
Welcome to the Happily Ever After Divorce Podcast. This is attorney Sarah Kaki with Atlanta Divorce Law Group, and I'm joined by our very own managing partner, Shauna Woods. Shauna, today we're going to talk about why people usually do not experience their divorce as a transactional process. And, you know, the answer seems to be pretty obvious because divorce involves breaking up of a long-term relationship that could have involved kids, that could have involved other family members. Obviously, the common questions everybody deals with in a divorce is, okay, what did we share as far as a car, as far as a house, as far as our assets? Who's going to live where? Who's going to get what? But past all of those transactions, there is a story of what brought us here, what brought us to this breaking point of doing the next best thing for the family, which is going our separate ways instead of staying in a dysfunctional, unhealthy relationship. And that story usually sets the stage for how the transaction can be done. I know you deal with it a lot in managing our attorneys, helping them strategize how to, you know, present a case, how to advocate for our clients. I work with it a lot on the front end when I meet clients and decide what can we do for them and are they the right fit for us. So I'll give you a quick example before we dive deeper into this. One of the cases we recently took on is husband and wife who've been married for 20 years. We are talking to the wife. She had at some point had an emotional affair on the husband, and they don't have any minor kids, but this was like 8 years ago. They worked it through in therapy and stayed together. And now after 8 years, she's finding herself tempted to step out on the marriage again. And instead of doing that, is coming to us and saying, you know what, instead of me doing this stupid thing and being out of integrity and being dishonest to my partner and being dishonest to myself and my own values, I need to leave this marriage for X, Y, and Z reasons. That's not the point of this conversation. But the point is, there's no children. Their assets are very clear, right? Any divorce attorney would look at it and say, okay, there's a marital home. We got to figure out who wants to live in it, who wants to buy who out, or are we selling it? And there's no conversation of alimony because they both make pretty equal pay. So it's not a typical alimony case. So anybody would look at this and say, oh, it's a transaction of splitting up a marital home absent any other assets, right? Let's just simplify the facts here. But it turns out, Shauna, it isn't going to be that simple because he felt cheated on once, worked through it, did the vulnerable work to do everything he needed to forgive her, stayed married to her. And she, when has been staying put for a long time out of guilt, and now is going to go ask him for a divorce that he's not going to want or might not easily give to her because he wants her to pay the price for, you almost broke our marriage up once and now you're actually really going to do it. This is what we're talking about when we say divorces are not typically transactional. I know you have a ton of experience with this, and this is usually what separates, I think, a good divorce attorney from a great one, the one that really gets to the bottom of what lies behind the numbers.
And, you know, I do think that Georgia law, and I just want to kind of clarify this for anybody who's listening outside of Georgia or people who don't know what Georgia states about equitable division. I think this lends to the story of divorce in a couple of different ways. Georgia allows you to argue what's fair instead of saying we're just going to divide things 50-50. And I think that's a good thing and a bad thing all at once. Because for some cases, it should be a transactional divorce. It should be a very straightforward. We have a house. We have a couple of retirements. We don't have any minor children. It should be a very straightforward, you know, couple of months dealing with a couple of logistics and divorce. but we're not dealing with unemotional people. We're dealing with people who their whole lives have been tied into this is where they thought they were going to be. And in your example, the husband really did feel like, I have a life with this person. So what they're struggling with, what he's struggling with, is he has to deal with the reality of this marriage not being, and all of a sudden you're just throwing numbers at him saying, sign here. So part of it, as we're representing this one woman, is telling the story in a way that's palpable, right, to the other side so that they can understand that prolongating this litigation isn't in their best interest, right? It's not, there's nothing to fight over in that particular situation. Even if her quote unquote adultery, and I'm putting that in quotations for our podcast listeners, even if that was the breakup of the marriage, a lot of times you're still looking at a 50-50 division. When I think that the Georgia law does it right is when the story goes beyond, why should we do this, something other than a 50-50 division, and learning that person's story is really important. But you have to be able to tell the difference between when is a story going to be compelling to the court, and when is the story just part of the psychology that goes into the negotiations of getting us pretty close to where we all think we need to be in this divorce case? And those are two definitely distinct stories. So if I may.
Yes. I think that's exactly it. I think this is why it sets advocates apart, because when you understand the story, even if you're from your view as an attorney, you can't do anything about it in court. You can, and maybe you can't even do anything about it in negotiation because we're not even there yet, but you can help advise the clients to what their next steps are, and sometimes help advise the client on not blowing their own case up. Because one of the things I had to explain to this client is, it's done for you, and that's why it's transactional to you. It's not done for him. That's why it's not transactional to him. And that's usually when, in those rare cases, when you truly have a transactional divorce and when they're both completely on the same place on where they are emotionally with this. When both parties are truly done and the emotional attachment is gone, and the story doesn't have a trigger point for them anymore, doesn't have those open wounds in it anymore, then we're in a best case scenario for it being transactional. But even with that, Shauna, I have still seen the factor of maybe the other party's over it too. Maybe they're done as well, but they have family members to answer to, or they may have a religious organization to answer to. How are they going to tell the story to them? Because they can't present their divorce to their religious organization or to their family members as a transaction. They want answers that goes beyond that. We see that a lot in some different cultures that happens. You know, I come from a Middle Eastern culture, so there is definitely some answering to family at times. I know in a lot of our Indian clients, we face this a lot, where they're like, you know what? Our families are going to have a meeting. They're going to literally meet and discuss this amongst themselves. And we've helped Indian clients before where they've said, we want to get this completely done and divorced amongst ourselves because the two of us are completely on the same wavelength before our families find out, so that they can't get involved and make this non-transactional for us. I mean, I know you have dealt with this so many times. I see you shaking your head.
I'm laughing a little bit because I've had that exact scenario with specifically Indian clients who are like, we're not telling our families we're even getting divorced until this is signed and done. And then I've had the opposite where everybody's uncle was involved. Literally, there would be a family meeting sitting in my conference room, you know, talking about what it is we need to do. And it's really hard because the story, and I can say this as a parent, you know, when your child is going through something or your really close family member is going through something, good gosh, you want to get in there and kind of, no, let me tell you why it's unjust that they have the waffle maker, right? And there's a big story about the waffle maker. And I'm making light of the waffle maker, but there was a case in which I did very early on in my career where the mother of my client was very passionately involved, and she was helping tell a story, but part of her story was telling how she hand sewn the wedding dress, right?
Oh man.
And how much love and, you know, patience went into sewing on these little beads. And it was hard for us to tell her story because she only spoke Farsi, and the only Farsi interpreter was on the telephone. So it was hard to tell the story, but you could just tell, even though there's a language barrier, the passion she had about how she welcomed this woman into her life and how hurt the entire family felt about what she was doing, right? And that was part of the story. And I'm not going to tell people that their stories aren't unique, because they are. They're a little bit different. There's only sometimes I'll tell them, yes, the court can absolutely do something about that. I've got an example of one of those. And sometimes I will have to say, I fully hear your story. I'm compassionate with you. But the court's not going to be taking those things into consideration. And that's a harder conversation to have with the clients, because at that point in time, I can't do much for them. I will give you an example of both. One of the hardest things for me to tell somebody who has been in abusive situation, whether it's physical abuse or significant mental and emotional abuse or financial abuse, is, and they tell me that how long they've put up with it. Well, I put up with it for 10 years. I put up with it for 20 years. And at the end of the day, they're not rewarded for putting up with it, Sarah.
Yeah.
They really do feel like they deserve something, right? Bigger than just maybe 50% of the assets or maybe some spousal support. Like, they want some vindication.
Retribution,
because you know what? They held that in. They didn't tell anybody that they were going through this abuse for so long. And unfortunately, most of the time, you're not going to see much of a financial difference in those particular situations. Now, there are some times when we do have different financial situations. And an example is, we had a client very recently who we both know the spouse is not going to be involved in their young son's life. Simply not even interested in it. And not taking any kind of financial responsibility other than what the court is making this person do. And what we got was a lump sum award of child support, because everyone highly suspects this person's going to ditch and try to run away and hide. And they're not working, but they did have financial assets. So we were able to compellingly, over a couple of days, tell a story to the court. And when I first broached the subject of lump sum child support to the court, I'm not going to lie, the judge rolled her eyes at me. Mm-hmm. And so being able to really tell your client's story in a way that's going to make a difference to perhaps a jaded court is a unique thing that I think that you really have to have a passion for. It's, you can learn it, but you really have to be born with that ability to help share someone else's story in a compelling way. And I want to be very clear, just because I tell you the court may not see this the way I see it doesn't mean your story isn't compelling. It just means, with my experience, I can see what the court's probably going to do and probably not going to do. And I'm going to give you a realistic version of what can happen in court. Circling back to your story, do you want your story to be one of, I came to this conclusion, I can make these decisions, I'm ready to settle? Or is it one that has to be told?
I love that, Shauna. And I think that at a minimum, even if you don't ever get your story told in court. At a lesser degree, it can be used in negotiation. And then a step beyond that, even if it doesn't reach that level, I think it helps if you can have an advocate on your side that helps get out your story or helps you understand your own story, like brings to light your own story. Because sometimes we're carrying our story and we don't even know what it is. We just are reacting to our present day realities without understanding what brought me here. What's the story behind this, right? If Hollywood was to make a movie, where would, you know, the whole plot line rise and fall? And I think it's so fantastic if you can at least see it and say, okay, I'm the person here that has lived through the climax of this story and am done and resolved. But I need to, in order to get to where I want to be, I need to meet the other person where they're at right now. And they're still in the rise of the conflict. They haven't yet hit that like aha breaking point. I see what it is. Now I can work towards a resolution point. And you have to, and to get where you want to be, you have to meet that person there. And sometimes that's very painful when to you, this is clearly transactional. And in reverse, it is very painful when your other spouse has gone through the entire emotional process and come to their conclusion, grieved it, decided that they're done, and they're now ready for a transactional divorce. And you're still fighting for therapy. You're still fighting for, can we work on this? But there's a story there. And sometimes, you know, there's always the cliche line. There's three sides to every story. Each person has their own, and then there's the truth. But being clear on what's my story, what's the other person's story, and how do I navigate that in my head to game theory? If I do X, what are they going to do next? That might not always be necessarily a legal strategy. That might be simple as, what is a conversation I need to have in order to meet them where they're at so we can de-escalate this from a high conflict divorce when I really in my heart believe it could be transactional.
And that's called building in the win for me.
I love that line.
The other side is either a high conflict person or they're just still really in their emotions. Whether they're in the emotions because they didn't want this divorce or they think that you've wronged them. You have to build something in where they can come back and ask for it to be changed or a counteroffer in a way that you're okay with. So you build in the win, right? You figure out what is it you believe is really important to them and you don't give it to them right away. You don't go, of course, you're going to get, I'm just making things up, the Christmas decorations, right? That's a trite example, but of course you're going to get those. But then in the negotiations, you actually ask for half of them and then they come back. No, I want all of them. Okay. You can have all of them, right? You build in that little bit of a win and it's not a bad thing. You know, people think that because we're thinking through this very structurally, very logically, that it has to be, oh, it's a bad thing to do this. No, you're giving somebody else something they can hang their hat on and say, I feel good because I got this. And that's okay.
You know, Shauna, you nail on what is the source of what's important in a story. And that's the character self-identity in the story. Who do they get to be in the story? And whatever the person you're divorcing, their identity is, their story is tied up in that identity. So a lot of times what I see, especially when with our women clients who are just done. And to them, it's like transactional. And we've talked about this before. When women are done, they're done. And sometimes when the men are done, they're still not ready to get divorced because I really, one of the things I love about men, and I've learned this through studying men through Alison Armstrong, is they have, when they've committed to something, even when things get really bad, they have a hard time letting go of it. Whereas women, we just don't, when we're done, we are willing to break the commitment. Now, whole conversation, different conversation about what led to that. But the point is, a lot of our women clients who are done and want this to be transactional and come to us and say, I know he's done too. I know he's fed up. I know he's just as miserable as I am, but I don't know why he's holding on to this. And then we talk about the story of the marriage, Why are we here? What happened? What are the conversations you guys are having right now? And then a lot of times we realize that he may identify himself as a married man, or he may just really be so identified to being a family man, or he might be so identified to being a good husband, or he so identifies himself to this marriage commitment he made, or the way he gets to present himself to his other married friends as, I'm one of you, I'm also married. And it is, we have to navigate through, how do we let him keep part of his identity and let you get the divorce, and not attacking that identity piece that's wrapped up in the story is usually where, I'm going to use your phrase, you can build in the win, is understanding what is the character identity the other side is so married to in their own story that this divorce could possibly attack, and that's why they're keeping this from being transactional.
Yes. Two things on that. One, sometimes their story has to be, and this takes a really strong person to kind of say, yep, mea culpa, the divorce is my fault, you're the good guy, right? Sometimes that person on the other side has to hear, I'm the good guy, right? Which there really is, that's never that black and white in a divorce. But a lot of times their emotions are all tied up in, I have to be the good person. I didn't ask for this divorce, whether it's religious or cultural or whatever it is. One thing I do like about a lot of men is they have that protective vibe. They have that nurturing vibe. And it's hard to let that go. But, and I'm going to circle back a little bit to studies, but studies show that single women after divorce are one of the happiest demographics out there. And single men after the divorce are one of the most saddest demographics out there. Now, I don't think that this podcast is a time to delve into all the psychology that goes into that.
Oh, but we will in the future. Can't let that one go.
But at the same time, I do think there's something to be said when we see female clients saying, I am done and I am ready to be happy, whether that means I'm happy alone or in another relationship. And the other partner thinking, I need a relationship. They may not even be holding on to this one. They just need one.
Absolutely. Well, thanks, Shauna. I think that, that does it for this episode.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Happily Ever After Divorce podcast. If you'd like to learn more, go to AtlantaDivorceLawGroup.com/resources.